Hello, this is Alex Litter, and welcome to Late Night Radio Istina. We went earlier today from 1 to 5:30 Central Time, and we talked quite a bit about a number of things, and I see that the archives are already up and kicking, so that's great. Great work on the part of our archivist. Now, we're going to go a couple hours tonight, and what we're primarily going to discuss is Captain A.H.M. Ramsay's The Nameless War. Now, let's get in the spirit with a Guns N' Roses song called Get in the Ring. And that's what we want from you listeners.
I don't like you, I just hate you, I'm stuck with it through all the fucking shit and to all those posts.
Well,
all right. With that, we'll dive into talking about people who made a world out of anarchy, brought anarchy to a settled, well-functioning world. Those people are called Jews. And we'll kind of triangulate onto this subject from three different texts, but today we're going to principally concern ourselves with the Nameless War, which is the name given by Captain A.H.M. Ramsay, who was jailed for his troubles, to the war carried on by Jews against whites over several centuries, culminating in a series of effective revolutions, including the British Revolution, that is, the restoration of imposition of Cromwell, the execution of the king, and the re-letting in of Jews who had been banned from Britain for several hundred years prior, the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, World War I, World War II, and the war in Spain in the 30s, and all these were Jew-instigated, essentially communist in nature, revolutions meant to destroy the freedom of the people, to turn over their lives, blood, treasure, and their prosperity to an international cabal of moneylenders. And today, earlier, we were talking a little more about I threatened to talk about the French Revolution. We are going to talk about that a little tonight. I'm doubting we're even going to get to the Jones tonight, but we are going to get through the first two chapters of Ramsay's The Nameless War, and probably I will read you every word in it. It's a very short, tight book. It names the Jew, and it explains what's going on in ways that you have probably never heard anyone outside of VNN talk about, and no one at VNN talk about in this depth. And here, I'm not particularly well-educated in this stuff myself, with regard to either the revolution in England, or Cromwell, or the French Revolution. I'm still learning about these things. I know a little from reading Jones. I still have not read Noah Webster's text, which I guess also identifies the Jews, nor have I read the text that Jones refers to, written by a guy long ago. I think it's Abbe Barrowell's History of the Jacobins. And he goes into depth about the involvement of secret societies in the French Revolution. And I don't know that he mentions Jews, but the Jews are highly sensitive to the kind of information he's talking about. Anyway, he's someone Jones deals with. Ramsay, however, does name the Jew. But what we're going to talk about, we've talked about Jones and Illuminism being created in the later 1700s by Adam Weishaupt over in Ingolstadt in Germany and spreading through the Masonic lodges into France and across the continent and even into America. We've talked about the techniques they developed for soul spying and soul control to put the passions of the people in the hands of the controllers who knew how to manipulate them. We're going to get a slightly different take on it today from Ramsay, who was, as I said, thrown in jail for perceiving correctly that the war against nationalist Germany was not in Britain's interest and might lead to her destruction, in fact. And he was thrown in jail for that. I'll read you what it says in the back. And again, one of the reasons, I bought about 100 books about a year ago, and I've only read about 20 of them, but I got them all with an eye not only toward educating myself, but specifically to read and discuss them on the radio. And thanks, Dietrich, for having some patience with me today. We had a number of problems, and I want someone to notify me if I'm not coming in right. We try to get the sound levels correct, and I don't want to obsess about it. I know sometimes I might come in a little low and the music come in a little high, but we're trying to get it about right, and I think I've got it about right now. And in any case, we seem to have a fairly well-working system, and that's due to our technical people, both Dietrich in setting up the system and our archivists in providing you with the archives, because we get a lot more downloaders than we do live listeners, although we have plenty of those as well. And we appreciate you sending around the MP3s of this to people. That's the reason that we're doing this, to get this information out there. There is an embargo on it. They attempt to suppress this stuff. I had to buy The Nameless War off Amazon.com or from some other service, because it's not the kind of book you can walk into Barnes & Noble and find, because it contains the information that you need to know to understand the world. And so what we're going to do tonight, and I'll go as long as it takes, we're going to cover the first 35 pages, the first two chapters. Pretty simple, clear stuff, but it will give you an understanding you will never get in school. And I know, I majored in international relations, and they never talked about any of this stuff, and it's far more relevant and pertinent what you can get from two or three books than from what you can get from a college education. So think of this as not only Radio Istina, Radio How It Is in Russian, Radio Reality, Truth, Factuality is the what Istina means in Russian. But think of it as an Aryan State Radio, Aryan State University Radio, Jew 101. Now, on the back cover, this is kind of a pink book with a white faceplate, The Nameless War by Captain A.H.M. Ramsey. Captain Archibald Maul Ramsey, that's Maul, M-A-U-L-E, Ramsey, R-A-M-S-A-Y, and I have a link to this book on the front page in the intro to Late Night Radio Istina, couple down from the top, September 18th, 2007. Captain Archibald Maul Ramsey was educated at Eton and the Royal Military College, Sandhurst. It's where Prince William went, so this is the elite military college, and served with the 2nd Battalion Coldstream Guards in the First World War until he was severely wounded in 1916. Thereafter at Regimental Headquarters and the War Office and the British War Mission in Paris, until the end of the war. From 1920, he became a member of Her Majesty's Scottish Bodyguard. In 1931, he was elected a Member of Parliament for Midlothian and Peebleshire. Arrested under Regulation 18B on the 23rd of May 1940. Again, he's arrested under Regulation 18B on the 23rd of May 1940, so, you know, time of World War II. He's arrested. He was detained, pay attention, without charge or trial in a cell in Brixton Prison until the 26th of September 1944. So from May 40 to September 1944, that is 4 years and a few months, 4 years and 6 months or so, or 4 or 5 months, he's thrown in jail for over 4 years for speaking truths that the Jew-controlled government wanted suppressed, that Winston Churchill wanted suppressed. He was speaking a lot, very similar truths to what Churchill, as a journalist, was writing back in 1920 about the Bolsheviks, which we discussed earlier today, which was basically the plan for the reordering of Russia and potentially all of Europe and America and the globe on the basis of arrested development, envious malevolence, and impossible equality, i.e. the Jew as the evil nerd murderer. And what Ramsey does in his book is, so imagine, before getting to that, just imagine this. This guy is a member of parliament, and he's thrown in jail for 4 years for trying to tell the British people what's actually going on and why they're actually getting into war. Conceivably, he posed the danger to the government of threatening them by concluding some sort of a peace treaty, say, with Hesse, or encouraging the leaders of the government to do just that, and thereby preserve the British Empire, save the lives of hundreds of thousands of good British men, and preserve Europe for the white race as opposed to the Jewish Bolsheviks, who ended up taking it over. And we see that on the morning following his release, he resumed his seat in the House of Commons and remained there until the end of that parliament in 1945. So basically, they had no reason. They did what they did to Padilla here. They simply arrested and threw him in jail because they didn't like what he was saying. Now, maybe that's not exactly the case with Padilla, but they held him without charge or trial. Now, they finally did try Padilla, but it was obviously a kangaroo court that tried him. They had no reason to do anything to Ramsey. He was an honorable military person who was also a member of parliament, and they threw him in jail, saying that, you know, he's working against the government under Regulation 18B. Well, they always have some pretext, don't they? Now let's read what they say, what the introduction to this book says. And again, these are short, quick chapters detailing the Jewish cause of the British Revolution, the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution. And then he has a chapter on the development of revolutionary technique, and then he has a chapter on Germany, Bell's the Cat. You see, that's what people need to get over their dislike of the Nazis and understand that the Nazis understood what the Jews were up to, and for the first time in history, they did something about it. They were the most recent ones in history, at least, that did something about it. And they did it during a period of mass media, which is what we face now. That's what they didn't have in the old days. They had pamphleteering. But they didn't have the full electronic spectrum that we have today for amplifying and disseminating messages to the public and miseducating them. So, essentially, he talks about the Jewish role in the British, French, Russian, Spanish, and German revolutions or would-be revolutions, attempts to communize them and subject the people to the predation of international Jewish moneylenders. Here's what they say. Here's the story that people have said would never be written in our time. The true history of events leading up to the Second World War, told by one who enjoyed the friendship and confidence of Mr. Neville Chamberlain during the critical months between Munich and September 1939. Here I want to interject something. Neville Chamberlain is remembered for one reason only. He supposedly appeased Hitler. Now, that is the term that the people who were actual appeasers, people like Ann Coulter, who actually appeased the Jews, use about a good man who attempted to preserve Britain and the Empire by recognizing that Germany had legitimate rights to protect its own people in what was then called Poland, but had only been Poland for a few years after the First World War. So Neville Chamberlain is not a bad guy, and he looks better every day in retrospect as we see what is becoming of Britain, where you're not allowed to speak any kind of truth these days about minorities and crime under the complete dictatorship of the Jew, for which people like Tony Blair are simply frontrunners, simply facemen, simply facades to fool the people. Even a very, very intelligent goy like Edmund Burke, you know, I was reading some of his in the half hour before coming on, even he was somewhat he made a number of negative references to Jews in his works, but he doesn't fully grasp how much the Jews were the ones operating the French Revolution. How much they, producing is a better term. The Jews produced the French Revolution, using terrorists and sickos and madmen like Desaad and Marat and Dante and these others. They used these masons, these suckers who only understood one or two levels of what was going on, and whenever they needed to dispose of these people, whenever they got too close to the center of the onion, why, they just shucked them off. They poisoned them or killed them in some other way. So, that's what's going on. Even Burke, and it's not that he's not intelligent or he can't figure it out, he's more intelligent than just about anyone, and he can write as well as anyone, and he has refined sentiments, and he thinks carefully about things. Those are all valuable qualities, but he may not have fully known the true history of the French Revolution at the time that he was writing this. After all, Ramsay is writing with another 150 years of evidence that have come to the surface, whereas Burke is writing about 1790, right around when it's happening, and his aim, his mission, is to prevent the same thing from happening in England, to ensure that people see the French Revolution for what it is, and that means basically dealing with actual acts committed by the revolutionaries and dealing with their actual claims about their mission and contrasting their sanguinary insanity with the settled unthinkingness of English ways. And I'll leave it right there for right now, but Let's read the little pup piece in the start. For some strange reason, this book is not blurbed by the usual sources. I wonder why that is. There has long been an unofficial ban on books dealing with what Captain Ramsay calls the Nameless War. Can any of you listening out there think of a parallel to the Nameless War? Something immediately comes to mind. And to me, it's... To me, it's the term that Paul Sheehan used in his Sydney Morning Herald article. He called his war the Dirty War. And the Dirty War itself, the war of black on white, is itself part of the Nameless War. It's one of the techniques by which the Nameless War is carried out. The War on Whites is carried out in part through the use of terror, and part of the use of terror is through the liberation of those unfit to be liberated, i.e. the Negro race, whose rapine and murder redound to the disbenefit of the whites who created the beautiful settled society the Jews wish to subvert for their own commercial and political profit and their genocidal self-serving ends. You understand? So we Aryans are always in the position of having to name things that go unnamed, because to name them, when you name something, it's not just handy in that it's hard to talk about things you can't talk about because they don't have names. It's not just that. It results in a public acknowledgement that something exists. And so, if something exists that's important and has weight and has effect on things, it must be named, and it must be named the correct name. That's why we came up with Loxism, to describe the hate that Jews have, and boy, we'll see good examples of that here in the next 2 hours. Other than Loxism, there is no public acknowledgement that Jews hate whites. It's the only word that acknowledges it. In fact, Jewish communism has no name to acknowledge it other than political correctness, which itself was, well, the correct term, or the term that it apparently came from in Soviet Union, was Parteinost, which was sort of the spear that you're supposed to have, and political correctness referred to deviation from the proper spirit or the party line. And political correctness came to public notice in the U.S. through Jewish cartoonist Jeff Shesolet Brown and his Politically Correct Man in the early 80s. Other than that, there's no acknowledgement of this incredibly destructive, malevolent, overwhelming force that has tried to reorder relations between races and sexes and classes in the U.S. for the last 40 years. Other than that, there's no acknowledgement of it. So if we have to come up with the terms, that's what we must do. That's up to our leaders. So always, never fear to create the acknowledgement of something that needs to be acknowledged and talked about. The hate that dare not speak its name, Loxism. They call us anti-Semites for resenting Jewish behavior that affects us in a profoundly negative way. What's the word for the Jew? The Jewish attitude, the Jewish motivation, the drive behind the Jews doing things that affect us in a profoundly negative way. What's his motto? He's a Loxist. He hates whites. Tries to destroy white society. He's a Loxist. That's how you got to look at it. And something beats nothing. If there's no word, then we all proceed on the false basis that only whites forever and eternal hate Jews and threaten them and are prejudiced against them, but Jews never hate whites. Have you ever seen it written up that Jews hated whites and took action against them? No, you don't. You never see it written up that way. Now, there has long been an unofficial ban on books dealing with what Captain Ramsay calls the Nameless War. Now, here's yet another benefit of the internet, is you can find these books even if you have to buy them. Now, the Nameless War, in fact, is available online. That may have been what I linked to. I think it is, in fact. You can read the whole thing online. It's only 120 pages, and it's pretty simple, short, quick paragraphs. And it covers a lot of ground, but it sums up the lessons of it the way a good book should. It's not windy. There has long been an unofficial ban on books dealing with what Captain Ramsay calls the Nameless War, the conflict which has been waged from behind the political scene for centuries, which is still being waged, and of which very few are aware. The publishers of The Nameless War believe this latest exposure will do more than any previous attempt to break the conspiracy of silence. The present work, with much additional evidence and a fuller historical background, is the outcome of the personal experiences of a public figure who, in the course of duty, has discovered at first hand the existence of a centuries-old conspiracy against Britain, Europe, and the whole of Christendom, i.e. the West. The Nameless War reveals an unsuspected link between all the major revolutions in Europe from King Charles the First time to the abortive attempt against Spain in 1936. One source of inspiration, design, and supply is shown to be common to all of them. Let me read that again, a little better emphasized. One source of inspiration, design, and supply is shown to be common to all of them, right? Doesn't that also echo Winston Churchill's article in 1920 where he talks about Jews being the inspiration and the driving power behind communism? Not just in the Soviet Union, but in Bela Kuhn or Bela Cohen in Hungary, Rosa Luxemburg in Germany, Emma Goldman in the U.S. Jews had the idea. Jews were the master implementers, the producers. The people out front aren't always Jews. In fact, almost more often than not, they're not Jews. But the ones in back, the people setting this stuff up, thinking it through and implementing it and making it happen, those are Jews. After a brief review of the forces behind the declaration of war and the worldwide arrests of many who endeavored to oppose them, the author describes the anatomy of the revolutionary international machine, the machine which today continues the plan for supranational world power, the age-old messianic dream of international Jewry. Interesting. Think about that. This, is written in, like, I think 1952 is when this is published. So he's talking about the New World Order back in the 50s. He's saying there's been a centuries-long global plan to reduce the non-Jewish world to slavery under an international Jewish order. And succeeding decades would only go to prove his point, as with the current war in Iraq and the intended war in Iran. Now, there are a couple little blurbs here from publications you haven't heard of, except for maybe one. Which would be the Daily Worker, but let's start with the first one. From, a magazine called Truth, something I've never heard of, it says Christians say, Captain Ramsay, a Christian gentleman of unflagging courage, believed that war with Germany was not conceived in the interests of Britain and could only lead to the extension of communist and Jewish power. Because he warned his fellow countrymen of the forces at work, he was put in prison without trial for 4.5 years for reasons so preposterous that those who framed them dared not submit them to a court of law. As I said, they just threw him in prison for 4 years for no reason other than he threatened the designs of international Jewry, the forces he describes in this book. Another little blurb. For years, Captain Ramsay had been a member of the British Parliament. His book is an analysis of the Jewish Zionist war against Christian civilization. That's from The Cross and the Flag. Back then, I guess there were even a handful of Christian publications that would actually describe the Jew, and in so doing, call the Jew a Jew, and deliberately refer to Jews having a plan to undermine Christian civilization. They won't do that today. The most they'll do is make money denouncing some of the manifestations of the Jewish agenda of cultural subversion for whites. But they'll never trace it back to the cause because they don't have any integrity. The writers are all bought. They're all flown over to Israel on El Al jets and given the grand tour, the grand violin tour. And they're made to understand that they will not be able to earn their daily bread unless they kowtow to Zion and toe its line. That's the way the world actually works. But not all white men toe the Jews' line. Some of them actually have some standards. And if you're one of us, you're listening to the right show and you're in the right place, and we want you to join us in whatever capacity you can help. Now, here's what the Jews say about this book, The Nameless War, by Captain A.H.M. Ramsay. Jews say, there is no limit to the depths of human depravity. Captain Mal Ramsay seems to have made a very determined attempt to plumb those depths. That's from the Jewish Chronicle. I guess I would have to take that as them saying that his investigating and discovering the Jewish cause of these horrible, bloody revolutions shows that he himself is depraved, which is a pretty typical Jewish response. And then we have one from the Daily Worker, which you may or may not know is a communist organ, the Daily Worker. They say, The publication of such a book at this time underlines the urgent need for the law to be reformed so as to make it a crime to preach racial hatred or punish libels on groups in the community. You know what? I wish I knew what year that was said, but it had to have been said probably sometime in the early 50s. Now think about that. What have I said before? I've said that when you try to trace the origins of some policy or some program or even some term or some label, you find generally that it goes back much farther than you ever would have thought. So that although the British may have put in these speech controls, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, the demand for them goes way, way, way far back. So you find the Communist paper saying this probably when the book originally came out in the 50s, when they still had the freedom of speech they no longer have. The Daily Worker, the Communist, i.e. the Jew, was calling for the restriction. You shouldn't be able to do that. You should suppress any material critical of the Judeo-Bolsheviks, as the Germans called them, the Jewish Bolsheviks. Communism is Jewish, as Rabbi Stephen Wise, one of the most prominent Jews of the first half of the 20th century, said. He said, some call it communism, I call it Judaism. Communism equals Judaism, just as neoconservatism equals Judaism. Both communism and neoconservatism were founded by Jews, who proudly proclaim it. So you understand, this stuff goes back a long way, just as when you look at the immigration debate in the U.S., the United States was still not under Jewish control in 1924, although it was quick getting there. And they were tired of being swamped with millions of alien people, including many, many, many Jews, so they decided to pass an act that would restrict new incomers to the percentage of their stock already in the country and thereby preserve the racial makeup of the country. And the Jews were most strongly against this. They didn't use the term racist, they used the term nativist and Nordicist. And they bashed and smeared as best they could, but they didn't have enough media organs on their hands. And the legacy of WASP sanity and freedom that the other groups, like the Germans and the rest, had assimilated to was still strong enough to withstand what they said, although they are already on their back. They're already backpedaling and taking pains to, oh, I'm not a racist. And that time they said, I'm not a Nordicist, but we have this problem we have to deal with, and they dealt with it. And that delayed for four decades the Jewish push to admit non-whites and thereby swamp and elect a new people. They got what they wanted, not in 1924 when they tried to get it, but they got it in 1965. And since then, immigration has been 90% non-white, probably higher than that. So, with this said, we're now ready to get into the book proper. And what we're going to discuss, and again, here again, I said stuff goes back farther than you think. It's not just the French Revolution. It actually goes back to the English Revolution. He calls it the British Revolution. And this would be the murder of the king and the installation of Cromwell and the readmission of the Jews. And the Jews promised Cromwell what Ramsay's going to talk about. He said, look, you get rid of the king, you get in power, you let us back in the country, we'll give you a bunch of money. And that's what they did. And then from there they went on. Remember, they'd been kicked. To understand history, you got to have the timeline first. They'd been kicked out of the country in like 1290. Now, this is about 400 years later, the mid-1600s to the end of the 1600s. They get back in power. They establish the Bank of England in 1690. And pretty soon, you know, they've limited the money to what they produce, and they're on the gold standard, and they're allowed to create money out of thin air and loan it at interest. And that's how they steal money from the people who actually work the land to produce real value. That's how you do it when you can produce money out of thin air and loan it at interest. You have a recipe for very quickly bringing in millions to yourself and bringing everybody else low. Thomas Jefferson said, as I quoted earlier today, he said, you know, if you allow a national bank like the Bank of England, what's going to happen is by alternately inflating and deflating the currency, they're going to turn you into slaves in your own land. So Thomas Jefferson, he's often misportrayed by liberals as some kind of a Whig or radical. He was pretty sensible about most things. And national banking and racial biological reality were two of them. Now let's see what Ramsay says. I'm just going to pretty much read this straight up and then insert some comments where appropriate. And we'll go through chapter 1 and chapter 2. Chapter 1 discusses the British Revolution, and chapter 2 discusses the English, or the French Revolution, and the role of the Jews in both of these. Prologue. He says, Edward I banished the Jews from England for many grave offenses, endangering the welfare of his realm and lieges, which were to a great extent indicated in the statutes of Jewry enacted by his parliament in 1290, the commons playing a prominent part. So, Edward I banished the Jews from England in 1290. Now, the period we're going to be talking about is from, say, 1648 until roughly 1700. And he says, okay, so Edward I banished the Jews in 1290. You got that down? Jews are kicked out of England in 1290. The King of France very shortly followed suit, as did other rulers in Christian Europe. So grave did the situation for the Jews in Europe become that an urgent appeal for help and advice was addressed to them by them to the Sanhedrin, that's the Council of the Top Jews, then located at Constantinople. That's over in Turkey. This appeal was sent over the signature of Chemor, C-H-E-M-O-R, Rabbi of Arles, I'm showing my ignorance here, A-R-L-E-S, I know a little French, but I don't always know how to pronounce it. Rabbi of Arles in Provence on the 13th of January, 1489. So that's another 170 years later. The reply came in November of 1489, which was issued over the signature of VSS, VFF, Prince of the Jews. It advised the Jews of Europe to adopt the tactics of the Trojan horse, i.e. to make their sons Christian priests, lawyers, doctors, etc., and to work to destroy the Christian structure from within. So they're going to subvert Christianity. I would say, okay, they're going to kick us out of England, they're going to kick us out of Spain, they're going to kick us out of France, and these city-states, and what will become Germany, what are we going to... Well, you know what? I think we better go underground. Keep your Judaism, but keep it private, and go underground, become Christians, become doctors, lawyers, other powerful positions, and worm your way back through these institutions in order to subvert them. That's what we're going to do. The Sanhedrin is the council of the top Jews. And the Jews being a Levantine people, they're from the southwestern Asia, the Orient. They're not Western people. That's a very important thing, because part of their bogus term, Judeo-Christian, is intended to suggest that Jews are somehow Western. They're not Western. Kevin MacDonald explicitly denies that in his book. They have different ways. They're a different type of people. They're a different subspecies. They have different ways of operating. So the Sanhedrin tells the Jews of Europe to go underground and then subvert the Christian institution. Remember, at this time, there's no mass media as we know it. Printing only comes in with Gutenberg and what? You know, the first part of the 1500s. So you don't have the radio, you don't have the TV, you don't have the satellites to beam propaganda across Christendom. What you have are settled institutions. You have men on horseback. You have ships. Stuff is much slower. It's slower and more local than it is today. So the Jews, you can see how the Jews love consolidated power. Well, naturally, they would love anything that allows them electronically to cut distance, and thereby a minority controlling the satellites and the broadcast and the amplifiers can control a large majority in what it thinks it knows about the real world. The first notable repercussion of this advice occurred in Spain in the reign of Ferdinand and Isabella. Many Jews were by then enrolled as Christians, but remaining secretly Jews were working to destroy the Christian church in Spain. Those would be Muranos. So grave became the menace finally that the Inquisition was instituted in an endeavor to cleanse the country from these conspirators, these subverters. Once again, the Jews were compelled to commence an exodus from yet another country whose hospitality they had abused. And the Jews will often cite in America, they'll cite George Washington's letter to some Hebrew congregation, I think in Rhode Island or something, and he said they were welcome, but he said they had to demean themselves properly, and that is exactly what they have never done. And remember, George Washington had no reason, he was not an intellectual, he had no reason to know anything about Jews at all. So the Jews are very dishonest in presenting their letters, though it's some kind of, you know, wonderful recommendation of their people. In fact, the Jews have demeaned themselves horribly in America, and therefore, their time is up. They have no legitimate reason to be here. So, the Jews are kicked out of Spain. They're kicked out of England in 1290. They're kicked out of other parts of Europe. They get nervous. They say, what do we do? What do we do? What do we do now? You underground, you must go. subvert the institutions, you must. Become doctors, become lawyers. Hey, sometimes the advice you give is not so good. You know, so that's what this worst of all known peoples is up to in the middle decades of the 1,000 years following Christ's death. Well, no, in the teenage years following Christ's death. So they're kicked out of Spain. Trekking eastward, these Jews joined other Jewish communities in Western Europe. Considerable numbers flowed onto Holland and Switzerland. Interesting. I knew about Holland. I didn't know about Switzerland so much. From now on, these two countries were to become active centers of Jewish intrigue. Jewry, however, has always needed a powerful seafaring nation to which to attach to itself. Great Britain, newly united under James I, was a rising naval power which was already beginning to sway the four corners of the discovered world. And remember, Ramsay himself is a captain in the Navy. Here also there existed a wonderful field for disruptive criticism, for although it was a Christian kingdom, England under James I, yet it was one of the most sharply divided, as between Protestant and Catholic. Well, how did Jews operate? By way of deception, thou shalt do war, and they do war also by dividing and conquering, setting race against race, working to aggravate natural divisions, and the same with sex and sex, and the same with class and class. Wherever there's a little tiny crack, Jews work to create a pothole, and ultimately an earthquake. A campaign for exploiting this division between Protestant and Catholic and fanning hatreds between the Christian communities was soon in process of organization. How well the Jews succeeded in this campaign in Britain may be judged from the fact that one of the earliest acts of their creature and hireling, Oliver Cromwell, after executing the king, according to plan, was to allow the Jews free access to England once more. So the Jews, this is the end of the prologue. The Jews are kicked out of England in 1290 by Edward the First, and they're readmitted under Oliver Cromwell after he or his people kill the king and displace him. So that's, you know, that's 350 to 400 years later. So in that time, apparently the British forgot what the Jews were all about. So that's part of the knowledge, that's part of the social technology whites need to keep, is that Jews are negative for these reasons. They must never be allowed to operate in your country because they form a hostile parasitic element, a fifth column in your country that is never loyal to that country but always loyal to itself, and it works against that country. So now we're going to have the story, essentially, of Cromwell and how the Jews got back into England and what they did once they got there. And this is the story of essentially the last 50 years of the 1600s. Let's see here. Okay. Looks like our levels are okay and we're broadcasting and we got people listening, so all is good with the world right now. And we're looking at about 11:44 on the 18th of September 2007. I'm going to take a sip here and just think. My voice a little harshed out after doing a few hours earlier today. But I'm feeling in fine throat, nevertheless. Now, this is something else. Chapter 1, The British Revolution. Quote, "It was fated that England should be the first of a series of revolutions, which is not yet finished." How about that? Who do you think said that? "It was fated that England should be the first of a series of revolutions, which is not yet finished." Is that Ramsay talking, or is he quoting someone? Well, I already told you he's quoting. Who's he quoting? Why, he's quoting Isaac Disraeli, father of Benjamin, Earl of Beaconsfield. Commenced his two-volume Life of Charles I, published in 1851, with these cryptic words, "It was fated that England should be the first of a series of revolutions, which is not yet finished." So England, France, Russia, etc., etc., etc. A work of astonishing detail and insight, that would be The Life of Charles I, published in 1851 by Disraeli. A work of astonishing detail and insight, much information for which, he states, was obtained from the records of one Melchior de Salome, French envoy in England during that period. The scene opens with distant glimpses of the British kingdom based upon Christianity and its own ancient traditions. These sanctions binding monarchy, church, state, nobles and people in one solemn bond on the one hand, and on the other hand, the ominous rumblings of Calvinism. Now remember, Christianity has been unified under the Pope. Sometimes there's more. Okay, let's see. I think we're back now. Let's see. We had a little glitch there. This was a glitch due to this thing popping up for Simplecast. So I don't know how much I lost right there, but we're back. Luckily, I'm watching the bar, so it should stay off. Okay, so we're back. I don't know what we lost there, but anyway. Anyway, I don't know where I cut off. It can't have been more than maybe a minute ago, but we're starting with chapter 1, and the starting words are, "It was fated that England should be the first of a series of revolutions which is not yet finished." That's a quote from Ramsay. He's quoting Isaac Disraeli, father of Benjamin Earl of Beaconsfield, commenced his two-volume Life of Charles I, published in 1851, with those words. And he says that it's a work that's built in large measure on the papers of a French envoy to England during that period named Melchior de Salome, who I would assume is a Jew. Again, the words are, "It was fated that England should be the first of a series of revolutions which is not yet finished." The scene opens with distant glimpses of the British kingdom based upon Christianity and its own ancient traditions. These sanctions binding monarchy, church, state, nobles, and people in one solemn bond on the one hand, and on the other hand, the ominous rumblings of Calvinism. Now, Calvin, who came to Geneva from France, where his name was spelled Cauin, C-A-U-I-N, possibly a French effort to spell Cohen, says Ramsay. Now, that to me is fascinating. If anyone can speculate plausibly on Calvin being originally Cohen, I'd be interested to hear it. I know, for example, that Bella Kuhn, I didn't know until I read it somewhere, and I can't remember where I read it, but Kuhn was the main communist revolutionary in Hungary, where they carried out just incredible mental tortures and physical tortures of people. Kuhn is just a deviant spelling of Cohen. Cohen is the rabbi clan of Judaism. So you always have to be careful. There are variant forms, but they're all the same thing. Is Calvin one of those, like Kuhn and like Cohen? Is it a variant of that? I've never heard that before. And I don't know that it's anything more than speculation, but anyhow, Calvin and these early Protestants who followed Luther and then branched off on their own and did battle among themselves, they had different princes and dukes who sponsored them or allowed them to preach in Rome freely while other people would cut their head off. So there's a little bit of ferment, maybe less so in England, but that's what he's saying here, is that when Calvin showed up, when Calvinism showed up, it introduced some problems. So he says, "Calvin, who came to Geneva from France, where his name was often spelt Cauin, possibly a French effort to spell Cohen, organized great numbers of revolutionary orators, not a few of whom were inflicted upon England and Scotland. Thus was laid the groundwork for revolution under a cloak of religious fervor." Interesting. "On both sides of the Tweed, these demagogues contracted all religion into rigid observance of the Sabbath. To use the words of Isaac Disraeli, the nation was artfully divided into Sabbatarians, that is, Seventh-dayers, and Sabbath-breakers. Calvin, states Disraeli, deemed the Sabbath to have been a Jewish ordinance limited to the sacred people." He goes on to say that when these Calvinists held the country in their power, it seemed that religion chiefly consisted of Sabbatarian rigors, and that a British Senate had been transformed into a company of Hebrew rabbins. And rabbins is a sort of a fancy rabbi. So what they're saying is that the Protestant, or at least this version, this Calvinism, was somewhat Judaic in essence. It was kind of like CI. It wasn't CI, but it was kind of like it in its desire. Hey, we're going to be the real Jews. We're going to copy some of these Jewish practices and claim we're the new Jerusalem. Now this is interesting. This is interesting. Okay, when Ramsey speculates that Calvin came from France, where his name was originally spelled C-A-U-I-N, not C-A-L-V-I-N. That's the anglicized version. C-A-U-I-N in France. He went to Geneva from France. And there's an asterisk here, and he said, and he speculates it's possibly a French effort to spell Cohen. Note, at a B'nai B'rith meeting in Paris reported in Catholic Gazette in February 1936, he was claimed to be of Jewish extraction. Wow, fascinating. Never heard that before anywhere. Don't know if it's true. So was Calvin actually Cohen? Was he trying to foment communist revolution under the guise of a new Protestant religion? I don't know. Anyway, so Ramsey says, or quoting Disraeli, in 1650, after the execution of the king, an act was passed inflicting penalties for a breach of the Sabbath. So that's kind of the Judaization of the law. Buckingham, Strafford, and Laud, or Laud, are the three chief figures around the king in these early stages, men on whose loyalty to himself, the nation, and the ancient tradition Charles can rely, King Charles can rely, Charles I. Buckingham, the trusted friend of King James I, and of those who saved his life at the time of the Gowrie Conspiracy of ominous Kabbalistic associations, was assassinated in the early years of King Charles's reign under mysterious circumstances. Strafford, who had been in his early days inclined to follow the opposite faction, later left them and became a staunch and devoted adherent of the king. This opposition faction became steadily more hostile to Charles, and by the time they were led by Pym, P-Y-M, had decided to impeach Strafford. The king, writes Disraeli, regarded this faction as his enemies, and he states that the head of this faction was the Earl of Bedford. Walsh, the eminent Catholic historian, states that a Jew wine merchant named Roussel, R-O-U-S-S-E-L, was the founder of this family in Tudor times. With the impeachment and execution of Strafford, the powers behind the rising Calvinist or Cohenist conspiracy began to reveal themselves and their focus, the city of London. At this time, there suddenly began to appear from the city armed mobs of, quote, operatives, unquote. The medieval equivalent for workers, no doubt, says Ramsey. Let me quote Disraeli. They were said to amount to 10,000, with warlike weapons. It was militia for insurgency at all seasons, and might be depended upon for any work of destruction at the cheapest rate. As these sallied forth with daggers and bludgeons from the city, the inference is obvious that this train of explosion must have been long laid. So the Jews are ginning up mobs of people to create problems, to get rid of the authorities and replace them with either their own henchmen or themselves, or their own henchmen as facades, with George Bushes that they could be the neocons behind. It must indeed, and we must recollect here, he's referring to the long-laid nature of these plans, it must indeed, and we must recollect here, that at this time Strafford was still unexecuted, and civil war in the minds of none but of those behind the scenes, who evidently had long since resolved and planned it. These armed mobs of, quote, workers, unquote, intimidated all and sundry, including both houses of Parliament and the palace at critical moments, exactly on the model employed later by the Sacred Bands and the Marseillais in the French Revolution. So he's saying that what we saw in the French Revolution, which is generally considered much more significant and prominent than the English Revolution, was actually carried out by the same means. These vast mobs of people who were intimidating everybody, who were raised and funded by Jew radical revolutionaries after their own ends. That's what he's saying here. Isaac Disraeli draws again and again startling parallels between this, and again this is a Jewish writer saying this, draws again and again startling parallels between this and the French Revolution, notably in his passages on the press, quote, no longer under restraint, unquote, and the deluge of revolutionary pamphlets and leaflets. From 1640 to 1660, he writes, about 330,000 appear to have started up. Those would be revolutionary pamphlets and leaflets. from 1640 to 1660, about 30,000 appear to have started up. And later, quote, the collection of French revolutionary pamphlets now stands by the side of the French tracts of the age of Charles I, as abundant in number and as fierce in passion, unquote. He goes on, whose hand behind the curtain played the strings, could post up a correct list of 59 commoners, branding them with the odious title of Stratfordians or betrayers of their country? Whose hand indeed? So what the Jews are doing is demonizing people they don't like and demonizing powers that are not in their hands as evil so that they can destroy them and take over. But Disraeli, who knew so much, now discreetly draws a veil over that iron curtain. It is left to us to complete the revelation. To do so, we must turn to such other works as the Jewish Encyclopedia, Sombart's work, The Jews and Modern Capitalism, and others. From these we learn that Cromwell, the chief figure of the English Revolution, was in close contact with powerful Jew financiers in Holland, and was in fact paid large sums of money by Manasseh ben Israel. Whilst Fernandez Carvajal, Carvajal, the Great Jew, as he was called, was the chief contractor of the new model army. So you understand, there's going to be a revolution in England. Cromwell's going to be the guy who comes in, but the reality of it is he's funded by Jews in order that he will let them back in the country and end the period of their banning, which was begun in 1290. So they will return and they will set up the Bank of England, and they will proceed to steal the birthright of Englishmen and set in place their own laws that will end up throwing people like Luke O'Farrell and Simon Shepherd in prison for speaking the truth about what's going on. And they would impose the same on us here in America. They just haven't got rid of the First Amendment yet. So even though this concerns matters 300-400 years old, it's directly relevant because these people have not been stopped since Nazi times. And it's up to us and our generation to stop them for all time. Now, so again, he was quoting Disraeli, and then he turned and started quoting Werner Sombart's The Jews and Modern Capitalism. I'll read it one more time just because it's important. From these sources, the Jewish Encyclopedia and Werner Sombart's The Jews and Modern Capitalism, we learn that Cromwell, Oliver Cromwell, the chief figure of the English Revolution, was in close contact with powerful Jew financiers in Holland. Remember, the Jews are chased out of Spain and England, these other countries. They went to Netherlands, they went to Holland, and they went to Switzerland, which both in turn became sources of radicalism and finances for radicalism, and was in fact paid large sums of money by Manasseh ben Israel, whilst Fernandez Carvajal, the Great Jew, as he was called, was a chief contractor of the New Model Army. Again, here my ignorance shows. I believe the New Model Army would be the mobs that they're raising to hasten and bring about the revolution. In The Jews in England, we read, quote, 1643 brought a large contingent of Jews to England. Their rallying point was the house of the Portuguese ambassador de Souza, a Murano secret Jew. Prominent among them was a Fernandez Carvajal, a great financier and army contractor. In January of the previous year, that would be 1642, the attempted arrest of the five members had set in violent motion the armed gangs of quote-unquote operatives already mentioned from the city, from London. Revolutionary pamphlets were broadcasted on this occasion, as Disraeli tells us, bearing the ominous insurrectionary cry of, "To your tents, O Israel!" Shortly after this, the king and the royal family left the Palace of Whitehall. The five members with armed mobs and banners accompanying them were given a triumphal return to Westminster. The stage was now set for the advent of Carvajal and his Jews and the rise of their creature, Cromwell. He's saying Cromwell is a creature of the Jews, just the way George Bush is a creature of the Jews. They funded him and they advised him and they set his policy. And they defended him in all their media. And when he's done, they'll get rid of him. The scene now changes. The Civil War has taken its course. The year is 1647. Naseby, N-A-S-E-B-Y, has been won and lost. The king is virtually a prisoner while treated as an honored guest at Holmby House, H-O-L-M-B-Y. According to a letter published in Plain English on the 3rd of September 1921, Plain English is a weekly review published by the North British Publishing Company, edited by late Lord Alfred Douglas, who was Oscar Wilde's good friend. And the letter published in Plain English in 1921 has a quote, "The learned elders have been in existence for a much longer period than they have perhaps suspected. My friend, Mr. L.D. Van Valkert of Amsterdam has recently sent me a letter containing two extracts from the synagogue at Mulheim. The volume in which they are contained was lost at some period during the Napoleonic Wars and has recently come into Mr. Van Valkert's possession. It is written in German and contains extracts of letters sent and received by the authorities of the Mulheim synagogue. Mulheim is M-U-L-H-E-I-M. The first entry he sends me is of a letter received 16th June 1647 from O.C., Oliver Cromwell, by Ebenezer Pratt. In return for financial support, we'll advocate admission of Jews to England. This, however, impossible with Charles living. This is what Oliver Cromwell is writing through his second. He says, King Charles cannot be executed without trial, adequate grounds for which do not at present exist. Therefore, advise that Charles be assassinated, but will have nothing to do with the arrangements for procuring an assassin, though willing to help in his escape. So, apparently they have on paper Cromwell saying this, like, look, I'll let you back in, but you got to get rid of the king, and there's no legal grounds to do that right now. So I suggest that you assassinate him, but I can't do that myself. But I will help you escape if you can find an assassin. I'll help him escape. So in reply was dispatched the following. Let's see. In reply was dispatched the following, 12th July, 1647. So, you know, this is 350 years ago. To O.C. by E. Pratt. That's to Oliver Cromwell by way of Ebenezer Pratt. I guess he was some kind of intermediary or go-between between the Jews and Cromwell. We'll grant financial aid as soon as, maybe he was the Jews' agent, the Jews' non-Jewish agent. So Pratt writes to O.C., to Oliver Cromwell, we'll grant financial aid as soon as Charles removed and Jews admitted. Assassination too dangerous. Charles shall be given opportunity to escape. His recapture will make trial and execution possible. The support will be liberal, but useless to discuss terms until trial commences. So, look, just set it up so that, you know, oh, he's getting away. Hey, let's catch him and put him on trial and execute him, and then we'll support you, and we'll give you, you know, whatever money you want, or i.e. whatever money they want to give you. With this information now at our disposal, says Ramsey, the subsequent moves on the part of the regicides, that is the king killers, stand out with a new clearness. On 4th June 1647, Cornet Joyce, acting on secret orders from Cromwell himself and, according to Disraeli, unknown even to General-in-Chief Fairfax, descended upon Holmby House, where the king was, with 500 picked revolutionary troopers and seized the king. So in 1647, a guy acting on Cromwell's orders grabs the king. According to Disraeli, the plan was arranged on May 30th at a secret meeting held at Cromwell's house, though later Cromwell pretending that it was without his concurrence. So they're doing stuff at his order while he's retains plausible deniability, I guess. This move coincided with a sudden development in the army, the rise of the levelers and rationalists. Their doctrines were those of the French revolutionaries. In fact, what we know today is communism. So see, like I said, everything goes back a lot farther than you think. It's not just communism in Russia, it's communism in the French Revolution. Why it's communism back in not only in France in 1789, but in England 150 years before that. They were called levelers and rationalists. They go by a lot of different names, but it's the same thing, the same principles, the same forces at work. Jews have the inspirations. They come up with the labels, and they are the driving power behind it, and around them they accrete a bunch of stupid Aryan dupes and self-interested sellouts and appeasers of the Jews. And these radicals take over these countries and destroy them. These were the regicides, the king killers, who four times purged Parliament till there was left finally 50 members, communist-like themselves, known later as the rump. So they get rid of the people in Parliament who are not down with a plan to put in Cromwell and readmit the Jews. To return the letter from Mulheim Synagogue of the 12th, to return to the letter from Mulheim Synagogue of the 12th June 1647 and its cunning suggestion that attempted escape should be used as a pretext for execution. Just such an event took place on the 12th November of that year. Hollis and Ludlow consider the flight as a stratagem of Cromwell's. Isaac Disraeli states, contemporary historians have decided that the king, from the day of his deportation from Holmby to his escape to the Isle of Wight, was throughout the dupe of Cromwell, unquote. So, they seized him, and then they kind of let him run away like a cat might let a mouse run a couple of inches, and then they grabbed him again and used that as a pretext. Little more remains to be said. Cromwell had carried out the orders from the synagogue, and now it only remained to stage the mock trial. Maneuvering for position continued for some time, and it became apparent that the House of Commons, even in their partially purged condition, were in favor of coming to an agreement with the king. On 5 December 1648, the House sat all night and finally carried the question that the king's concessions were satisfactory to a settlement. So the people don't want to kill the king. Should such agreement have been reached, of course, Cromwell would not have received the large sums of money which he was hoping to get from the Jews. He struck again. On the night of December 6th, Colonel Pride, on his instructions, carried out the last and most famous purge of the House of Commons, known as Pride's Purge. So this is the fourth time they purged the House of non-Cromwell compliant members. On 4 January, the communist remnant of 50 members, called the Rump, capital R, invested themselves with, quote unquote, the supreme authority. Communist takeover of the House of Commons. On 9 January, a High Court of Justice to try the king was proclaimed. Two-thirds of its members were levelers, capital L, from the army. Levelers being another word for communist. Algernon Sidney warned Cromwell, quote, first, the king can be tried by no court. Second, no man can be tried by this court, unquote. So writes Hugh Ross Williamson in his Charles and Cromwell. And he adds a finishing touch to the effect that, quote, no English lawyer could be found to draw up the charge, which was eventually entrusted to an accommodating alien, Isaac Dorislaus. You see, even in that time, English lawyers were loyal enough to their own people that, you know, like, look, you guys are trying to pull off a bogus charade here in your kangaroo court. I ain't having no part of it, man. That's just ignoble. And so they refused to go along with it. So who was one? Well, an accommodating alien. You know, and I read this earlier today. I had the thought, wow, that's good. You know, part of naming the Jew should also be not only calling them like Jew Dershowitz, but call them like Alien Dershowitz. Alien Horowitz. Alien Zelikow. Alien Chertoff. It's another way of getting at that Jew part. Needless to say, Isaac Dorislaus was exactly the same sort of alien as Carvajal and Manasseh ben Israel and the other financiers who paid the, quote, protector, that would be Cromwell, his blood money. The Jews were once again permitted to land freely in England in spite of strong protests by the subcommittee of the Council of State, which declared that they would be a grave menace to the state and the Christian religion. Again, the Jews are once again permitted to land freely in England in spite of strong protests by the subcommittee of the Council of State, which declared that they would be a grave menace to the state and the Christian religion, which is, of course, was the case. Perhaps it is due to their protests, says Ramsey, that the actual act of banishment has never to this day been repealed. So the Jews are, in effect, allowed back into England when Cromwell takes power in 1648. But the act under which they were banned was never repealed. So technically, they're still banned. And that's something the loyal Englishman can make use of. Perhaps not today, but at some point. And sure enough, it was directly a mistake to allow the Jews back in, and a disloyal Arian did it. Because it was good for him, and he didn't care what was good for his country. Now, let's see. We're just a couple more pages, and we'll be done with the English Revolution. And I'm pretty ignorant of this. I know just a little bit, just enough to be dangerous, but I see here a pattern that I'm long familiar with. And works like this, I think, are almost more useful than these 400-page tomes that so many authors write, because it distills things into very clear motives and people. So you see, oh, he did this for this. Okay, that's something we can all relate to. How did the Jews get back into England when they were banished? Well, this guy wanted to be king, and the Jews were in position to arrange that and finance it. So he did it. He didn't really care about what was good for England in the long term. That's just the kind of person Cromwell was. Simple, easy to understand, documented. out of Jewish sources. You don't even need to go to non-Jewish sources. They'll admit what they're doing in their own pages. So Jews are let back in with the return of Cromwell, or with the accession of power of Cromwell after purging the parliament and putting the king on trial. The Jews are back in, but the act of their actual banishment was never repealed. The English Revolution under Charles I, writes Isaac Disraeli, was unlike any preceding one. From that time and event, we contemplate in our history the phases of revolution. There were many more to follow on similar lines, notably in France. In 1897, a further important clue to these mysterious happenings fell into Gentile hands in the shape of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. In that document, we read this remarkable sentence. Remember the French Revolution. The secrets of its preparation are well known to us, for it was entirely the work of our hands. That's from the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. The elders might have made the passage even fuller and written, remember the British and French revolutions, the secrets of which are well known to us, for they were entirely the work of our hands. The difficult problem of the subjugation of both kingdoms was still unsolved, however. Scotland was royalist before everything else, and she had proclaimed Charles II king. Cromwell's armies marched around Scotland, aided by their Geneva, i.e. Protestant, sympathizers, dispensing Judaic barbarity. There's a good phrase to be used. Judaic barbarity. But Scotland still called Charles II king. He moreover accepted the Presbyterian form of Christianity for Scotland, and slowly but steadily the feeling in England began to come round to the Scottish point of view. Finally, upon the death of Cromwell, all Britain welcomed the king's restoration to the throne of England. So, the interloper, Cromwell, comes in. But then he dies, and then they bring back the real king. But the Jews are still there. So, and they're much more powerfully situated than they ever could have been from without, where they may have had massive sums of money, and they may have had power and ability to influence, but how much more do they have when they're on the island itself, and they control government to a much greater extent? They don't influence, they control directly. In 1660, Charles II returned, but there was an important difference between the kingdom he had fled from as a boy and the one to which he returned as king. The enemies of kingship were entrenched within his kingdom now, and as soon as the stage should be set for renewing the propaganda against the papacy, and so dividing once more persons, all of whom considered themselves as part of Christ's church, the next attack would develop. The next attack would aim at placing the control of the finances of both kingdoms in the hands of the Jews, who were now firmly ensconced within. Charles evidently had no consciousness of the Jewish problem or plans or the menace they held for his peoples. The wisdom and experience of Edward I had become lost in the centuries of segregation from the Jewish virus. Edward I is the one who kicked the Jews out of England back in 1290. So he's saying, Ramsay's saying, the wisdom and experience of the guy who kicked the Jews out had become lost in the intervening, you know, 3.5 centuries, or the time from 1290, 1300 or so, until 1650 when they come back. So 350 years later, no one is as cognizant as they should be of the nature of the problem that Jews allowed to roam freely among whites can pose. That knowledge had been lost. A consciousness of the danger to the crown in placing his enemies in possession of the weapon of a, quote, popish plot, cry, he did retain. With James II's accession, the crisis could not be long delayed. The most unscrupulous pamphleteering and propaganda was soon in full swing against him. And it is no surprise to find that many of the vilest pamphlets were actually printed in Holland, again, a major Jewish power center. They're printing all kinds of pamphlets against James II. This country was now quite openly the focus for all disaffected persons, and considerable comings and goings took place during these years. Stories were brought to the king that his own brother-in-law had joined those who plotted against him, but he utterly refused to credit them or to take any action till news came that the expedition against himself was actually underway. The chief figure amongst those who deserted James at the crucial juncture was John Churchill, 1st Duke of Marlborough. It is interesting to read in the Jewish Encyclopedia that this duke for many years received not less than £6,000 a year from the Dutch Jew Solomon Medina. So again, they're paying people just as that you would pay, I believe, the probably the I'm going to guess great-great-grandson would be Winston Churchill. Possibly I'm wrong about that, but I don't think so. But the point is, Jews are paying, they're buying politicians 350 years ago, just the same way they're buying them now. Just as they own our Congress, they're the major donor to both parties, they were buying politicians to do their bidding back in the 1600s in England. The real objective of the so-called Glorious Revolution was achieved a few years later in 1694, when the royal consent was given for the setting up of the Bank of England, and he puts that in quotes, over the institution of the national debt, or and the institution of the national debt. This charter handed over to an anonymous committee, think of the parallel to the Fed here, a privately owned bank, the royal prerogative of minting money, converted the basis of wealth to gold, and enabled the international moneylenders to secure their loans on the taxes of the country instead of the doubtful undertaking of some ruler or potentate, which was all the security they could previously obtain. So they're basically saying, look, you guarantee your people and their labor against this money we're going to loan you that we print out of thin air. So we'll get rich and your kingdom will get poor. And we'll have you, the king, and the people in our power in no time flat. That's what they did. That's what happened. That's what the story that's been repeated across the West. From that time, economic machinery was set in motion, which ultimately reduced all wealth to the fictitious terms of gold, which the Jews control, and drained away the life and blood of the land, the real wealth, which was the birthright of the British peoples. The political and economic union of England and Scotland was shortly afterwards forced upon Scotland with wholesale corruption and in defiance of formal protest from every county and borough. The main objects of the union were to suppress the royal mint in Scotland and to force upon her, too, responsibility for the so-called national debt. I say so-called, he puts it in quotes, national debt. So he's putting all these things in quote, Bank of England, national debt. As always, the Jews misrepresent things to serve themselves, and they do that by calling something the Bank of England. Is actually the Bank of Judea, and the national debt is actually the debt forced upon the nation by the Jews, by another nation. The grip of the moneylender was now complete throughout Britain. The danger was that the members of the new joint parliament would sooner or later, in the spirit of their ancestors, challenge this state of affairs. Because remember, Runnymede, right? Funny that they had Runnymede, and then, you know, 50 years later, maybe within 100 years, they've run the Jews out of England. So there's a direct relation between freedom and no Jews. And the same with solid money and no Jews. They just don't go together. Jews don't go together with anything good, and they do go together with everything bad. So to provide against this, against the Englishmen taking up arms and weapons and words to defend their ancient prerogatives, or their hard-won prerogatives, their blood-won prerogatives, therefore the party system was now brought into being, frustrating true national reaction. Just like in America, they frustrate true national reaction. Because even though it's there and can see itself on the internet, they don't allow it in the mass media. So when someone like Ron Paul gets up there on Fox and starts talking sense, like let's pull out of Iraq and let's shut down our borders and let's lower taxes and let's get rid of the Fed, that's true national reaction. They frustrate that through their ownership of these mass media and their suppression and their attacks on anyone who might form a counter nobility or a counter leadership or a counter head to do battle with them. They suppress them and attack them. And they set up the party system to masquerade and to put out something for people, for average people to be fooled by. So they think, oh, Democrat or Republican, conservative or liberal, these are just ways for them to trick people and to prevent the coalescence of a body that can actually do battle with the real rulers, which is the Jews, the Jewish financiers, money men, and media men who are running the country in their interests. So you have to understand that. And this is hundreds of years ago, they're doing exactly what they're doing now. Their game doesn't change. Their guise changes. So he says, they brought the party system into being, frustrating true national reaction and enabling the wire pullers to divide and rule, using their newly established financial power to ensure that their own men and their own policies should secure the limelight and sufficient support from their newspapers, pamphlets, and banking accounts to carry the day. So everybody except for Ron Paul is a system man. And even Ron Paul himself, who denies race and its reality and meaning, is to that extent, which is a very large extent, a System Man himself. But even the appearance of a little bit of difference is so unusual that it thrills the people and it scares the powers that be. So far are we removed from the days when white men actually commanded their own lands, that even a little tiny white mouse equivalent of leadership and self-ownership is shocking to us all. It's so unusual. Ramsey says, gold was soon to become the basis of loans, 10 times the size of the amount deposited. In other words, 100 pounds of gold would be legal security for 1,000 pounds of loan. At 3%, therefore, 100 pounds of gold could earn 30 pounds interest annually with no more trouble to the lender than keeping track of a few ledger entries. So, the Jew makes money out of thin air and loans it at interest and quickly draws everything into his own coffers. The owner of 100 pounds worth of land, however, as opposed to $100 worth of loan, must still work every hour of daylight in order to make perhaps 4%. The end of the process must be only a matter of time. The moneylenders must become millionaires. Those who own and work the land, the Englishmen and the Scotsmen, must be ruined. And he says, writing, in 1950 or so, the process has continued inexorably till now, when it is nearly completed. It has been hypocritically camouflaged by clever propaganda as helping the poor by mulcting the rich. Right? Think about that in this country. Oh, the rich aren't paying their fair share of the taxes. Well, the truly rich are never on the table for discussion. They certainly aren't. They're there to benefit from the system that they set up. They themselves never come in for any blame. It has been in reality nothing of the kind. It has been in the main the deliberate ruination of the landed classes, the leaders among the Gentiles, and their supplanting by the Jew financiers and their hangers-on. Is that not exactly what we have in America today? It's run by the moneyed elite, and it follows a Jewish political agenda. And with that, we're done with Chapter 1. Now we're going to come back and do Chapter 2. That took a little longer than I thought, but it's very inspiring stuff, and the time goes by very quickly. And what I'm going to do now, play a couple of songs that someone sent me today, and let's see what we have. We're talking about armed mobs, so what we're going to do is play The Mob Rules by Black Sabbath as a tribute to the power of these evil mobs that the Jews have Jewish financiers. Jews, they have the high and the low, and they have the financiers, and then they have the mobs that they pay a little bit of money to attack the normal solid people with the wisdom and virtue to lead properly. Those are the ones the Jews want to destroy. So, we'll listen to, let's say, two songs, and then I'll be back, and we'll talk about Chapter 2, which is the same thing except in France. A little bit louder now. Here we go. We'll be right back. one more song now. To defeat these Jews we've been talking about, it's going to take some balls. And it's going to take more than that. It's going to take balls of a certain size. And here's a little song about that.
Society, God's gift to ballroom notoriety, and I always fill my ballroom, the event is never small, the social pages say I've got the biggest balls of all, I've got big balls, I've got big balls, they're such big balls, and they're dainty big balls, and he's got big balls, and she's got big balls. My ballroom always full, and everybody comes and comes again. If your name is on the guest list, no one can take you higher. Everybody says I've got great balls of fire. I've got big balls, oh I've got big balls, and they're such big balls, dirty big balls. And he's got big balls, and she's got big balls. Fancy dress, but when they're held for pleasure, they're the balls that I like best. My balls are always bouncing to the left and to the right. It's my belief that my big ball should be held every night.
Oh,
we've got big balls! We've got big balls! We've got big balls! Dirty big balls! He's got big balls! She's got big balls! But we've got the big balls!
And we're back. And we're going to conclude the day with a look at Chapter 2 of The Nameless War by Captain A.H.M. Ramsey. Let me check to make sure we're running here. Maybe I'll amp it up just a tad bit. Maybe. Now let's see how we're doing here. And what we've got, we just got done talking about the British Revolution and the Jewish role in that. And now we're going to talk about the French Revolution. And we've discussed earlier today that the reaction of the French Revolution and Edmund Burke's reflections on the French Revolution constituted the seminal work of modern conservatism, according to Richard Kirk. And there are many wise words in that, but and there are many words critical of this Jew or that Jew and Jews in general, and kind of snide references to Jewish counterfeit paper printers. I talked about that in the earlier Radio Astina earlier today. We won't talk any more about Burke tonight, but we will just do Chapter 2 of Ramsey. Still leaving aside the Marquis de Sade stuff from Michael Jones that we have to get back to, and the stuff about Mary Wollstonecraft, and all these English who kind of became radical revolutionaries. And they thought what was going on in France was pretty cool until they saw it up close, and they felt its effects on their lives, or at least the effects of the sexual immorality that they practiced after the French mode. Culminating in an interesting interpretation of Frankenstein, the work by Mary Shelley, who's the product of some of these radicals. But for now, what we want to talk about is the French Revolution and what Captain Ramsay has to say about it. He begins by saying, the French Revolution of 1789 was the most startling event in the history of Europe since the fall of Rome. A new phenomenon then appeared before the world. Never before had a mob apparently organized successful revolution against all other classes in the state under the high-sounding but quite nonsensical slogans and with methods bearing not a trace of the principles enshrined in those slogans. Never before had any one section of the nation conquered all other sections, and still less swept away every feature of the national life and tradition, from king, religion, nobles, clergy, constitution, flag, calendar, and place names to coinage. So, you know, the eternal desire of the radical. Wipe it all out and start anew, which is crazy. Such a phenomenon merits the closest attention, especially in view of the fact that it has been followed by identical outbreaks in many countries, says Ramsey. Now, let's see, what do we have here? The main discovery that such an examination will reveal is this fact. The revolution was not the work of Frenchmen to improve France. It was the work of aliens whose object was to destroy everything which had been France. This conclusion is borne out by the references to, quote, foreigners in high places in the revolutionary councils, not only by Sir Walter Scott, but by Robespierre himself. Robespierre being one of the radicals who brought about the revolution. We have the names of several of them, and it is clear that they were not British, or Germans, or Italians, or any other nationals. They were, of course, Jews. Let us see what the Jews themselves have to say about it. Remember the French Revolution, to which it was we who gave the name of Great. The secrets of its preparation are well known to us, for it was wholly the work of our hands. That's from Protocols of Zion, number 7. Here's another quotation from Protocols of Zion, number 1. We were the first to cry among the masses of the people the words, liberty, equality, fraternity. The stupid Gentile poll parrots flew down from all sides onto these baits, and with them carried away the well-being of the world. The would-be wise men of the Gentiles were so stupid that they could not see that in nature there is no equality, and there cannot be freedom, meaning, of course, freedom is understood by the socialist and communist, freedom to wreck your own country. Ramsey again. With this knowledge in our possession, we shall find we possess a master key to the intricate happenings of the French Revolution. The somewhat confused picture of characters and events moving across the screen, which our history books have shown us, will suddenly become a concerted and connected human drama. When we begin to draw parallels between France of 1789, Britain of 1640, Russia of 1917, Germany and Hungary of 1918-19, and Spain of 1936, we shall feel that drama grip us with a new and personal sense of reality. So he's pointing out the similarities and the parallels between all these different revolutions. That's kind of the theme of his book. They're all caused by Jews. We're at war with whites. Revolution is a blow struck at a paralytic, he quotes. Even so, however, it must be obvious that immense organization and vast resources, as well as cunning and secrecy far above the ordinary, are necessary for its successful preparation. It is amazing indeed that people should suppose that mobs, or the people, ever have or ever could undertake such a complicated and costly operation. No mistake, moreover, could be more dangerous, for it will result in total inability to recognize the true significance of events or the source and focus of a revolutionary movement. The process of organizing a revolution is seen to be, firstly, the infliction of paralysis, and secondly, the striking of the blow or blows. So they paralyze it, and then they knock its head off. It is for the first process, the production of paralysis, that the secrecy is essential. Its outward signs are debt, loss of publicity control, that is, media control, and the existence of alien-influenced secret organizations in the doomed state. Debt, particularly international debt, is the first and overmastering grip. Through it, men in high places are suborned, and alien powers and influences are introduced into the body politic. When the debt grip has been firmly established, control of every form of publicity, i.e. media, and political activity soon follows, together with the full grip on industrialists. The stage for the revolutionary blow is then set. The grip is of the right hand of finance, established the paralysis. The grip of the right hand of finance established the paralysis, while it is the revolutionary left that holds a dagger and deals the fatal blow. Moral corruption facilitates the whole process. Think about our Congress, completely bought by the Jews of Israel. And think about how corrupt they are. Think about how the Democrats elect a majority in their anti-war, and they don't even have the balls to get us out of the war. They just go along complicitly with whatever Bush wants. Think about how much debt we've incurred to carry on this war that aids only Israel. $2 trillion it's going to cost, they say. And they're now talking about calling up a draft. This is what he's talking about, translated into 2007 America terms. By 1780, financial paralysis was making its appearance in France. The world's big financiers were firmly established. Quote, they possessed so large a share of the world's gold and silver stocks that they had most of Europe in their debt, certainly France. So writes McNair Wilson in his Life of Napoleon, and continues on page 38. A change of a fundamental kind had taken place in the economic structure of Europe, whereby the old basis had ceased to be wealth and had become debt. In the old Europe, wealth had been measured in lands, crop, herds, and minerals, but a new standard had now been introduced, namely, a form of money to which the title credit had been given. The debts of the French kingdom, though substantial, were by no means insurmountable, except in terms of gold, and had the king's advisers decided to issue money on the security of the lands and the real wealth of France, the position could have been fairly easily righted. As it was, the situation was firmly gripped by one financier after another who either could not or would not break with the system imposed by the international usurers. Under such weakness or villainy, the bonds of usury could only grow heavier and more terrible, for debts were in terms of gold or silver, neither of which France produced. And who were the potentates of the new debt machine? These manipulators of gold and silver who had succeeded in turning upside down the finances of Europe and replacing real wealth by millions upon millions of usurious loans? The late Lady Queenborough, in her important work, Occult Theocracy, gives us certain outstanding names, taking her facts from l'antisemitism by the Jew Bernard Lazar and his brother Abraham Goldsmid, Moses Mokata, their partner, and his nephew Sir Moses Montefiore, as being directly concerned in financing the French Revolution, along with Daniel Itzig of Berlin and his son-in-law David Friedlander and Hertz Surfbier of Alsace. So these are the people who are financing the French debt and bringing about the French Revolution. Goldsmid, G-O-L-D, S-M-I-D, Moses Montefiore, M-O-N-T-I-F-I-O-R-E, Moses Mokata, M-O-C-A-T-T-A, Abraham Goldsmid, G-O-L-D-S-M-I-D, along with Daniel Itzig, I-T-S-I-G, David Friedlander, F-R-I-E-D-L-A-N-D-E-R, and Hertz Surfbier, C-E-R-F-B-E-E-R. These names are called the Protocols of Zion, and turning up number 20, we read, the gold standard has been the ruin of states which adopted it, for it has not been able to satisfy the demands for money, the more so as we have removed gold from circulation as far as possible. And again, loans hang like a sword of Damocles over the heads of rulers who come begging with outstretched palm. No words could describe more aptly what was overtaking France. Sir Walter Scott, in his Life of Napoleon, Volume 1, thus describes the situation. These financiers use the government as bankrupt prodigals are treated by usurious moneylenders who, feeding their extravagance with the one hand, with the other wring out of their ruined fortunes the most unreasonable recompenses for their advances. By a long succession of these ruinous loans and the various rights granted to guarantee them, the whole finances of France were brought to total confusion. King Louis's chief finance minister during these last years of growing confusion was Necker, a Swiss of German extraction, son of German professor of whom McNair Wilson writes. Necker had forced his way into the king's treasury as a representative of the debt system owing allegiance to that system. We can easily imagine what policy that allegiance inspired in Necker, and when we add to this the fact that his previous record was that of a daring and unscrupulous speculator, we can understand why the national finances of France under his baneful aegis rapidly worsened, so that after 4 years of his manipulations, the unfortunate king's government had contracted an additional and far more serious debt of £170 million. So this apparent Jew named Necker is running the finances and pushing the King of France, King Louis, into £170 million of debt. By By 1730, Freemasonry had been introduced into France from England. Remember, we're talking about Adam Weishaupt and E. Michael Jones creating Illuminism in 1776 or founding it. But these kinds of ideas were around for decades before. But they were hot at this point in history. By 1730, Freemasonry had been introduced into France from England. By 1771, the movement had attained such proportions that Philippe Duc de Chartres, afterward d'Orléans, became Grand Master. This type of Freemasonry was largely innocent, both in policy and personnel, in its early days, but as events proved, the real moving spirits were ruthless and unscrupulous men of blood. The Duc d'Orléans was not one of these latter. Though a man of little principle and an extravagant, vain, and ambitious libertine, he had no motives beyond the ousting of the king and the establishing of a democratic monarchy with himself as that monarch. Having, in addition, but little intelligence, he made the ideal stalking horse for the first and most moderate stage of revolution, and a willing tool of men whom he probably scarcely knew, and whom sent him to the guillotine soon after his base and ignominious role had been played. So the Jews play these stupid Aryans who are vain and ambitious, people like George Bush, and then they discard them when they're no longer useful, and then they blame them. Marquis de Mirabeau, M-I-R-A-B-E-A-U, who succeeded him as the leading figure of the revolution, was cast in much the same role. He was a much abler man than d'Orléans, but so foul a libertine that he was shunned by all his own class and imprisoned more than once at the insistence of his own father, rather like the Marquis de Sade, who, at the insistence of his mother-in-law, was in prison, whereupon he sublimated his Bundy-like talents into writing. Otherwise, he would have been raping and killing girls, as he simply wrote about in prison. E. Michael Jones says the general morals of France were lower than England, and that's partly why they succumbed to this Jewish disease of revolution and radical sexual liberation. So he's saying that number one guy, Duc d'Orléans, was used and discarded. Then Marquis de Mirabeau, he is known to have been financed by Moses Mendelssohn, head of the Jewish Illuminati, and to have been more in the company of the Jewess Mrs. Hertz than was her husband. He was not only an early figurehead in the French Freemasonry in the respectable years, but introduced Illuminism into France. This Illuminism was a secret revolutionary society behind Freemasonry. The Illuminati penetrated into all the lodges of Grand Orient Freemasonry and were backed and organized by Kabbalistic Jews. It is interesting to note that the Duc d'Orléans and Talleyrand were both initiated into Illuminism by Mirabeau shortly after the latter had introduced it into France, from Frankfurt, where its headquarters had been established in 1782 under Adam Weishaupt. Right? So now we get a few more details that we don't get from Jones. And you remember he concluded his chapter on Weishaupt talking about how his agents were spreading this into France, and a lot of people thought they were responsible for the revolution. So this picks up and somewhat amplifies that theme. So in 1785, there happened a strange event which makes it seem as though the heavenly powers themselves made a last-moment attempt to warn France and Europe against these massing powers of evil. Lightning struck dead a messenger of the Illuminati at Ratisbonne. The police found on the body papers dealing with plans for world revolution. Remember, Jones discusses this also. Thereupon, the Bavarian government had the headquarters of the Illuminati searched, and much further evidence was discovered. French authorities were informed, but the process of paralysis was too far advanced, and no action resulted. By 1789, there were more than 2,000 lodges in France affiliated to the Grand Orient, that's the Freemasons, the direct tool of international revolution, and their adepts numbered over 100,000. So pretty extensive. Thus we get Jewish Illuminism under Moses Mendelssohn, M-E-N-D-E-L-S-S-O-H-N, and Masonic Illuminism under Weishaupt, established as the inner controls of a strong secret organization covering the whole of France. So that's interesting. I've never heard Illuminism divided like that, but he says we get Jewish Illuminism under Moses Mendelssohn, Masonic Illuminism under Weishaupt, as the inner controls of a strong secret organization covering all France. Under the Illuminati work Grand Orient Freemasonry, and under that again the Blue or National Masonry had operated until it was converted overnight into Grand Orient Masonry by Philippe d'Orléans in 1773. Little did Egalité suspect that the satanic powers that he was invoking when he took that action, and satanic powers that he was invoking when he took that action, and satanic they certainly were. So, Philippe d'Orléans, or Galatea, I guess they called him, converted National Masonry into Grand Orient Masonry, which apparently had some deep meaning. The name Lucifer means light bearer, and Illuminati, those who were lit by that light. By the time the Estates General, or Etat General, met at Versailles on the 5th of May, 1789, that's the 1789 is the year of the French Revolution, the paralysis of the executive authority by the secret organizations was complete. Paralysis by control of public opinion and publicity was well advanced by then also. This was the manner of its accomplishment. By 1780, D'Orléans' entire income of 800,000 livres, L-I-V-R-E-S, livres, thanks to his reckless gambling and extravagance, was mortgaged to the moneylenders. In 1781, in return for accommodation, he signed papers handing over his palace, estates, and house, the Palace Royal, Palais Royal, to his creditors, with powers to form there a center of politics, printing, pamphleteering, gambling, lectures, brothels, wine shops, theaters, art galleries, athletics, and any other uses, which subsequently took the form of every variety of public debauchery. So, again, we see a politician in debt, allows the Jews to bail him out at the cost of becoming a puppet. In fact, Galatea's financial masters used his name and property to install a colossal organism for publicity and corruption, which appealed to every lowest instinct in human nature. Again, we're getting into E. Michael Jones territory. They're using every vice to enslave the French. And the French had overall lower morals than the English, according to Jones, at least at that period, at that point in time. So, Galatea's financial masters used his name and property to install a colossal organism for publicity and corruption, which appealed to every lowest instinct in human nature and deluged the enormous crowd so gathered with a filthy, defamatory, and revolutionary output of its printing presses and debating clubs. As Scudder writes in A Prince of Blood, it gave the police more to do than all other parts of the city. So this is like the filthy kikes turning the royal palace into a frat house. And a frat house that produces every kind of vice. And you've got crowds gathering around this, and it appeals to these nasty crowds. A bunch of bums and niggers and that kind of riffraff. You can just imagine it. Of course, not literally niggers, but abandoned people. It is interesting to note that the general manager installed by the creditors at Palais Royal was one Delaclos, a political adventurer of alien origin and author of Liaison Dangereuse, Dangerous Liaisons. You may remember the film from a couple years ago. And it's interesting, and this would be, no one could trump Desaad in being a pervert, but this was one of the guys who was along the same lines, and I gather they were characteristic. They were just exceptionally fine specimens of this degenerate class of French elite. And their immorality not only destroyed lives of others and damaged their own, their abandonness destroyed France because it allowed them to be taken over by these Jews. So the fish rots from the heads down is actually a French expression I read in one of these books. So he's pointing out that when the financiers got control of the Duke d'Orléans and they took over his palace and they used it as a center for all, you know, a giant shopping mall and a printing shop and center of every form of gambling vice and a casino, it's all these things in one. You got masses of scum starting to appear around there and listen to these demagogic harangues. And the general manager of this place is this Laclos, Delaclos, L-A-C-L-O-S, who's the author of Dangerous Liaisons and other pornographic works, who was said to, quote, to study the politics of love because of his love for politics. And that kind of picks up the Jones theme that sexual liberation is the same as political revolution. You rip off these ties, you have to come up with a way to control men, and that's what they're looking to do, is to rip these people free of all their social, customary, traditional moorings, as best described by Edmund Burke, the father of conservatism, and let them ride their passions and reap the whirlwind. and then they come to, and the Jews are in control of everything. The money in the kingdom. This steady stream of corruption and destructive propaganda was linked with a series of systematic personal attacks of the vilest and most unscrupulous nature upon any public characters whom the Jacobins thought likely to stand in their way. This process was known as l'infamy, the infamy. Think about this. This is exactly what we see a little bit going on right now. What do they all call us if we hold a rally in Knoxville to talk about the systematic dispossession and rape and murder of whites at the hands of Negroes loosed by Jews? They call us haters and extremists. That's what the infamy is. They mean to heap scorn, abuse, ridicule, and imprisonment on anybody who stands athwart their system. They mean to degrade us in the eyes of our own people who might otherwise follow us, if they were in their right mind, rather than brainwashed and conditioned by the Jews controlling the media, government, the courts, and the education system. You understand that? So this tactic is not new. Again, all these things go back hundreds and hundreds of years. So they're heaping abuse on the natural nobility, the natural aristocrats, the natural elites who might lead France, even at that late date, to safety. They're abusing those people's reputation. They're literally assassinating them, and they're figuratively assassinating them. They're killing their character, and they're killing the man, and they're killing the women who form a natural elite, a natural head, to lead the body that is France. They're turning the body against the head. They're cutting off the Aryan head and putting a Jewish head on its shoulders. Marie Antoinette was herself one of the chief targets for this typically Jewish form of attack, that is, l'infamie. No lie or abuse was too vile to level at her. More intelligent, alert, and vigorous than the weak and indolent Louis, Marie Antoinette presented a considerable obstacle to the revolution. She had, moreover, received many warnings regarding Freemasonry from her sister in Austria, and no doubt was by this time more awake to its significance than when she had written to her sister some years previously, when she didn't think it was that dangerous of a thing. She wrote to her sister, and I think she was Austrian in origin. "I believe that as far as France is concerned, you worry too much about Freemasonry. Here it is far from having the significance that it may have elsewhere in Europe. Here everything is open and one knows all. Then where could the danger be? One might as well be worried if it were a question of a political secret society, but on the contrary, the government lets it spread, and it is only that which it seems, an association of the objects of which are union and charity. One dines, one sings, one talks, which has given the king occasion to say that people who drink and sing are not suspect of organizing plots, nor is it a society of atheists, for we are told that God is on the lips of all. They are very charitable. They bring up the children of their poor and their dead members. They endow their daughters. What harm is there in all that? What harm indeed if these blameless pretensions mask no darker designs? Doubtless the agents of Weishaupt and Mendelssohn reported on to them the contents of the Queen's letter, and we can imagine them shaking with laughter and rubbing their hands in satisfaction, hands that were itching to destroy the very life of France and her Queen, and which at the appropriate hour would give the signal that would convert their secret conspiracy into the massacres of September and the bloodbaths of the guillotine. In order to further the campaign of calumny against the Queen, an elaborate hoax was arranged at the time, when the financiers and grain speculators were deliberately creating conditions of poverty and hunger in Paris. A diamond necklace valued at nearly a quarter of a million was ordered at the court jewelers in the Queen's name by an agent of the Jacobins. Those are the radical revolutionaries, the scum, and the leaders of the scum. The unfortunate Queen knew nothing of the affair until the necklace was brought round to her for acceptance, when she naturally disclaimed anything to do with the matter, pointing out that she would consider it wrong to order such a thing when France was in so bad a financial way. The printing presses of the Palais Royal, however, turned full blast onto the subject, and every kind of criticism was leveled at the Queen. A further scandal was then engineered for the press. Some prostitute from the Palais Royal was engaged to disguise herself as the Queen, and by a forged letter, the Cardinal Prince de Rohan was induced to meet the supposed Queen about midnight at the Palais Royal, supposing he was being asked for advice and help by the Queen on the subject of the necklace. This event, needless to say, was immediately reported to the printing presses and pamphleteers, who started a further campaign containing the foulest innuendos that could be imagined concerning the whole affair. The moving spirit behind the scene was Cagliostro, alias Joseph Balsamo, a Jew from Palermo, a doctor of the Kabbalistic art, and a member of the Illuminati, into which he was initiated at Frankfurt by Weishaupt in 1774. When the necklace had finally served its purpose, it was sent over to London, where most of the stones were retained by the Jew Eliasson. So there you go. They're setting her up, and then they're ridiculing her in the press. Jews lie. They assassinate characters, and they assassinate men. Attacks of a similar nature were directed against many other decent people who resisted the influence of the Jacobin clubs. After 8 years of this work, the process of paralysis by mastery of publicity, i.e. mastery of media, i.e. media control, was complete. So think about how the Jews abuse anyone who's against the craziness of the war in Iraq. Think about how they lied to get us into these wars. Think about how they routinely abuse the character of anyone who dares to point out what they've wrought with that crazy war. And what they hope to wreak in Iran. Do they treat arguments fairly ever, anywhere? No, they don't. They abuse them. They call you a terrorist or a terrorist helper, an extremist or a hater. Well, they were practicing these techniques back in France at the time of the revolution. In every respect, therefore, by 1789, when the financiers forced the king to summon the Etat General, the general states, that would be the church, the nobility, the king. The first portion of their plans for revolution, i.e. paralysis, were accomplished. It now only remained to strike the blow, or series of blows, which were to rob France of her throne, her church, her constitution, her nobles, her clergy, her gentry, her bourgeois, her traditions, her cultures. They're going to decapitate France. They paralyzed it with their money-mucking, their inflation and their usury, and their evil press. They've paralyzed it, and now they're going to chop the head off of it. They're going to destroy everything that made France France and kill any agents who could reconstitute it, leaving in their place, when the guillotine's work was done, citizen hewers of wood and drawers of water under an alien financial dictatorship. Wow, is that not exactly what they've done in the U.S.? From 1789 onwards, a succession of revolutionary acts were set in motion, each more violent than the one preceding it, each unmasking fresh demands and more violent and revolutionary leaders. In their turn, each of these leaders, a puppet only of the real powers behind the revolution, is set aside, and his head rolls into the basket to join those of his victims of yesterday. So, the Jews will use you, white traitor, and then they'll discard you, and they'll go on to the next one and do it again. Philippe Egalite, Duc d'Orléans, was used to prepare the ground for the revolution, to protect with his name and influence the infancy of the revolutionary club, to popularize Freemasonry in the Palais Royal, and to sponsor such acts as the March of the Women to Versailles. The women on this occasion were mostly men in disguise. D'Orléans was under the impression that the king and queen would be assassinated by this mob, and himself proclaimed a democratic king. The real planners of the march, however, had other schemes in view. One main objective was to secure the removal of the royal family to Paris, where there would be clear of protection from the army and under the power of the commune, or the Paris County Council, in which the Jacobins were supreme. They continued to make use of Egalite right up to the time of the vote on the king's life, when he crowned his sordid career by leading the open vote in voting for the death of his cousin. His masters thereafter had no further use for his services, and he very shortly followed his cousin to the guillotine amidst the execrations of all classes. So this guy sells out his own flesh and blood to serve his own ambitions, and he's soon discarded by the Jews, who are the real planners of this revolution, who are just using him. Mirabeau played a similar role to that of Egalite. He intended that the revolution should cease with the setting up of Louis as a democratic monarch with himself as chief advisor. He had no desire to see violence done to the king. On the contrary, in the last days before he died, mysteriously by poison, Mirabeau that is, he exerted all his efforts to get the king removed from Paris and placed in charge of loyal generals still commanding his army. He was the last of the moderates and monarchists to dominate the Jacobin Club of Paris, that bloodthirsty focus of revolution, which had materialized out of the secret clubs of the Orient Masons and the Illuminati. So he's saying pretty directly what Jones didn't conclude about, but he hinted that, you know, the Illuminists and the Masons and these secret societies and the Jews were the real source of the French Revolution. It was Mirabeau's voice, loud and resonant, that kept in check the growing rage of the murderous fanatics who swarmed therein. There is no doubt that he perceived at last the true nature and strength of the beast, which he had worked so long and so industriously to unchain. In his last attempt to save the royal family by getting them out of Paris, he actually succeeded in shouting down all opposition in the Jacobin Club. That evening he died by a sudden and violent illness, and, as the author of The Diamond Necklace writes, Louis was not ignorant that Mirabeau had been poisoned. Thus, like Philippe Egalité, and later Danton and Robespierre, Mirabeau, too, was removed from the stage when his role had been played. We are reminded of the passage in number 15 of the Protocols. We execute masons in such wise that none save the Brotherhood can ever have a suspicion of it. And again, in this way we shall proceed with those goy masons who know too much. As Mr. E. Scudder writes in his Life of Mirabeau, he died at a moment when the revolution might still have been checked. The figure of Lafayette occupies the stage on several important occasions during these first revolutionary stages. He was one of those simple Freemasons who are born, they know not whither, in a ship which they have not fully explored, and by currents concerning which they are totally ignorant. While a popular figure with the revolutionary crowds, he very severely handled several incipient outbreaks of revolutionary violence, notably in the March of the Women to Versailles, during the attack on the Tuileries, and at the Champs de Mars. He too desired the establishment of a democratic monarchy and would countenance no threat to the king, even from Philippe Egalité, whom he treated with the utmost hostility during and after the March of the Women to Versailles, believing on that occasion that Egalité intended the assassination of the king and the usurpation of the crown. He evidently became an obstacle to the powers behind the revolution and was packed off to a war against Austria, which the assembly forced Louis to declare. Once he did dash back to Paris in an effort to save the king, but he was packed off again to war. Mirabeau's death followed, and Louis's fate was sealed. The wild figures of Danton, Marat, Robespierre, and the fanatics of the Jacobin Club now dominated the scene. In September of 1792, so it's gotten progressively worse from 89 to 92, were perpetrated the terrible September massacres, 8,000 persons being murdered in the prisons of Paris alone, and many more over the country. It should be noted here that these victims were arrested and held till the time of the massacre in the prisons by one Manuel, procurer of the Commune. Sir Walter Scott evidently understood much concerning the influences which were at work behind the scenes. In his Life of Napoleon, Volume 2, he writes on page 30, "The demand of the Communauté de Paris, now the Sanhedrin of the Jacobins," Sanhedrin being a council of the rabbis, "was, of course, for blood. The demand of the Communauté de Paris, now the Sanhedrin of the Jacobins, was, of course, for blood." Again on page 56, he writes, "The power of the Jacobins was irresistible in Paris, where Robespierre, Danton, and Marat shared the high places in the synagogue." Writing of the Commune, Sir Walter Scott states in the same work, "The principal leaders of the Commune seem to have been foreigners." Some of the names of these foreigners are worthy of note. There was Chlodero, C-H-L-O-D-E-R-O, de Laclos, manager of the Palais Royal, said to be of Spanish origin. There was Manuel, procurer of the Commune, already mentioned. He it was who started the attack upon royalty in the convention, which culminated in the execution of Louis and Marie Antoinette. There was David the painter, a leading member of the Committee of Public Security, which tried the victims. His voice was always raised calling for death. Sir Walter Scott writes that this fiend used to preface his bloody work of the day with the professional phrase, "Let us grind enough of the red." David it was who inaugurated the cult of the Supreme Being and organized, quote, "the conducting of this heathen mummery, which was substituted for every external sign of rational devotion." It's from Sir Walter Scott's Life of Napoleon, Volume 2. There were Rubel and Gohier, two of the five directors, R-E-U-B-E-L and G-O-H-I-R, two of the five directors who, with a council of elders, became the government after the fall of Robespierre, being known as the Directoire. The terms directors and elders are, of course, characteristically Jewish. One other observation should be made here. It is that this important work by Sir Walter Scott in nine volumes, revealing so much of the real truth, is practically unknown, is never reprinted with his other works, and is almost unobtainable. Kind of like this book, The Nameless War. You have to look it up. It's not found in libraries. It's not found in bookstores. You can only really find it online. Very much like Sir Walter Scott's nine-volume, I guess, Life of Napoleon, which obtains which includes a lot of information about the Jews behind the French Revolution. Those familiar with Jewish technique will appreciate the full significance of this fact and the added importance it lends to Sir Walter Scott's evidence regarding the powers behind the French Revolution. Now, we're almost done here with this book. And we've got a couple more pages to go. We're done with the French Revolution. To return to the scene, Robespierre now remains alone and apparently the master of the scenes, but this again was only an appearance. Let us turn to the life of Robespierre by one G. Renier, R-E-N-I-E-R, who writes as though Jewish secrets were at his disposal. He writes, "From April to July 1794, the fall of Robespierre, the terror was at its height. It was never the dictatorship of a single man, least of all of Robespierre. Some 20 men, the committees of public safety and of general security, shared the power. On the 28th of July 1794, to quote Mr. Renier again, Robespierre made a long speech before the convention, a philippic against ultra-terrorists, uttering vague general accusations. I dare not name them at this moment and in this place. I cannot bring myself entirely to tear asunder the veil that covers this profound mystery of iniquity. But I can affirm most positively," and again, this is Renier quoting Robespierre, "I can affirm most positively that among the authors of this plot are the agents of that system of corruption and extravagance, the most powerful of all the means invented by foreigners for the undoing of the Republic. I mean the impure apostles of atheism and immorality that is at its base." So, Mr. Renier continues with all a Jew's satisfaction. Had he not spoken these words, he might still have triumphed. In this smug sentence, Mr. Renier unwittingly dots the I's and crosses the T's which Robespierre had left uncompleted. He's saying that Jewish atheists are the real source of the French Revolution, the real directors of it, the real controllers of it. Robespierre's allusion to the corrupting and secret foreigners was getting altogether too near the mark. A little more and the full truth would be out. At 2 a.m. that night, Robespierre was shot in the jaw and early on the following day dragged to the guillotine. Again, let us recall Protocol 15. In this way, we shall proceed with goy masons who know too much. Interesting. And then there's this odd conclusion. Note, in a somewhat similar manner, Abraham Lincoln was shot and killed by the Jew Booth on the evening of his pronouncement to his cabinet that he intended in future to finance U.S. loans on a debt-free basis, similar to the debt-free money known as greenbacks, with which he had financed the Civil War. I've never seen anybody ever accuse John Wilkes Booth of being a Jew, so I don't know what the basis of that claim is, but essentially he's saying that Lincoln was trying to operate outside of the debt financing favored by the Jews who controlled England and then France and had extended their influence to America even before the Revolution through that kind of financing. Now, that's what Ramsay has to say about the French Revolution and about the English Revolution. And let's see. Okay, we've been going for a little over 2 hours right now. Let's see, what have we got here? I think I'm going to leave it at that point right now, and we'll call that good for tonight. I'll run a few tunes. I'll play a few songs, and that will be good. I could get into Desaad, but I'm kind of talked out, and I think I want to... there's quite a bit about Desaad that Jones has to say, and we'll talk about that at a future time, but he has a complimentary take on the French Revolution. He doesn't go into it in quite as much detail, and actually the stuff about the English radicals and the way that they perceived and interacted with the agents of the French Revolution is quite interesting and informative and ought to be used to inform our politics and our own behavior. So, that said, we worked our way through 35 pages in the first two chapters. We're about a third of the way through the Nameless War, and we will end up going through the rest of it when I'm back, like next Tuesday. I'll be back before then, but probably I will pick up and do some more radio next Tuesday, and we'll talk about the Jewish involvement in the Russian Revolution as Chapter 3 of the Nameless War. or we'll do some articles, and we'll also talk about Desaad and Libido Dominandi, Sexual Liberation and Political Control. And I may read a little more Revolution and Reflection on the Revolution in France, which is worth going through itself at pretty good length. But the important thing here is that, you know, as in Disraeli's quote, you know, the world is history is the people making history are not those who appear on the world stage. They're not who most people think they are. Things are actually run by a small coterie of people behind the scenes, a few hundred people, and they're Jews, and they're the ones calling the shots. And so we see it was in England and even in France. So I will play a couple more. I'll play some tunes now, and then we will say goodnight. I'll let it run, I don't know, maybe 30 minutes, and then I'll turn it off. Let's see what we got that's any good here. Maybe you like these songs, maybe you won't. I'll play 1, 2, 3, 4, 6. I'm going to play about 7 songs, and then we'll end it. Where's the song I want to sign off on? Where is the song I want to sign off on? Where is it? Let's see. Trying to find a good song to close on. I've got 6 good ones right now, but I want to add one more here. And what do we got? Open my mouth and I pop something spiteful. Hell. I'll leave it where it is. I've got. We'll play our way out with I gotta admit, I'm a sucker for the minivan song. That's what we're gonna end with. But not yet. That's what we're gonna end with. So we're gonna hear 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3. 7 songs, and then I'm going to turn it off. So they're going to start right now. With this one. And again, thanks for listening. I'm starting to lose a little bit here. We've done 6.5 hours of radio today, a little bit of music, not a whole heck of a lot. I'm always looking for new tunes. I had someone send me a couple more, and I've used them today. And there are a couple other ones I will also use. But if you have new stuff that's a little offbeat, prefer country or pop to rock, prefer shorter to longer, get on Skype, send them to me as MP3, and I'll use them. So here we go. We're going to play about 6-7 songs, probably run about half hour, 40 minutes max. And we'll be out of here no later than 2. So I want to say thank you for listening. As always, these shows are archived, and we really appreciate if you help advertise what we're doing here by spreading the MP3 around and posting it on forums and posting it on blogs. Then I say goodnight, and I'll see you most likely next Tuesday on the radio.
Well, bugger off. you bastards, bugger off.
Fuck you!
Bugger off.
You bastards, bugger off.
Fuck you! Take a herd of bloody swine who refuse to leave the trough. You'll get no more this evening, so you bastards, bugger off. Will you let him flood the audience of my old time just pass? Now don't you be letting that door hit you in the ass. You've been a splendid audience, but enough is enough. We take it very kindly if you'd all just bugger off.
Bugger off, you bastards, bugger off.
Bugger off,
you bastards, bugger off.
Here's to the barkeeps and the waitresses who've been serving you your beer. They put up with your noxious breath and your stupid drunken leers. Be leaving all your money on the table when you go. Now you'll have a throbbing head and nothing else to show. So bugger off,
you bastards, bugger off.
Bugger off,
you bastards, bugger off.
Heard a bloody swine who refused to leave the trough.
He'll get no more this evening, so you bastards bugger off.
Here's to all the lovely ladies who might be waiting for the band, and thinking one of them might make a charming one night stand. Oh, please don't be offended, girls, the song's not meant for you, and we're happy to oblige you when this nasty job is through.
Bugger off, you bastards, bugger off. Bugger off, you bastards, bugger off. Take a herd of bloody swine who refuse to leave the trough. He'll get no more this evening, so you bastards, bugger off.
So now you're promising the ladies a night of loving bliss, when truth be told, your friends are drunk to stand up straight and piss. So give it up, your bloody socks, you'll not be getting laid. And the sooner that you're out the door, the sooner we'll be paid.
Bugger off, you bastards, bugger off. Bugger off, you bastards, bugger off. Take a herd of bloody swine who refuse to leave the trough. He'll get no more this evening, so you bastards bugger off.
Well, bugger off,
you bastards bugger off. Bugger off, you bastards bugger off. Take a herd of bloody swine who refuse to leave the trough. He'll get no more this evening, so you bastards bugger off. He'll get no more this evening, so you bastards bugger off.
Peace and love.